a can of Carabao. Hello, and welcome to episode 32 of this season's Real Football Cast. As always, I'm your host, Dan Tracy, and in the next 60 minutes, we'll be dissecting all the hot topics in football. As per usual, we'll be discussing what's been going on in the Premier League over the past few days, while in addition to that, there are also some off-pitch activities that have caught our eye, and they'll be getting our attention in the next hour. It's been another incredible week of football, and this week it's two up top. That means leading the line around the captain's armband is Matthew. So Matthew, how have you been since we last spoke?
Yeah, I've been pretty good. No Fulham available to ruin my weekend. So yeah, just a chance to sit back and relax and see, you know, all the meltdown and all the excitement that is going on in the rest of the world of football.
I'm glad you're doing all right. As you say, no Fulham means no defeat. But also, I'm joined by Palace fan Max. Max, it's a fortnight since you were back in the fold. How have you been, my friend?
Yeah, fine. Just obviously watching all the... all the mad events that have been happening in the world of football, and yeah, I just can't believe it. Really, it feels like it. I kind of dreamed it. It just happened so quickly, you know, within 48 hours, the rise and fall of the Super League. It was mad, really, wasn't it?
It was crazy. It was the craziest 48 hours known to man. Like I said, we did a podcast on the whole topic, and within 3 hours, it was out of date. It was a really good podcast, but it's kind of all moot because the plans have fallen through, which we'll get to in a moment. And before we do, I'd best do the social media bits, otherwise we'll be talking to the abyss once more. So first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can. That's on Twitter, at DanTracy1983. Also, the podcast has its own account, which is at RealFootballPod. If you want to become a shareholder, all you need to do is follow and join our very elite members club. Talking of clubs, I'm delighted to announce we're now part of the UK's first ever sports podcast network, that being Sports Social. So check out the URL and all the links posted on RealFootballPod throughout the week. You can find me via iTunes by searching for Real Football Cast. If you use that platform, don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. And if you like us, leave a review so we move up the league table. Also, I need to mention my two content partners. If you like betting tips, go to betting.com. If you like thought pieces from myself, go to nowsport.com. And the easiest way to find all the links is by going to linktree.com/realfootballcast. Put a dot between the R and the E and you get 10 podcast platforms to choose from. It's never been easier to listen to the show. Right, it's time to go live. And where should we go first? Well, Max, obviously you weren't here for that episode last week, but as I just said, we did discuss the European Super League at length. So I want to get your take on the collapse. Obviously, that mad 48 hours had to end at some point. What did you make of that final section?
It was an absolutely crazy denouement to the... I mean, maybe the most kind of momentous and seismic and dramatic 2 days in football for, you know, decades. It was absolutely mad. But I mean, my reaction, I think a lot of initial reaction for fans was just complete shock that they had the brass bollocks to try something like that. But at the same time, you know, a lot of other writers have said, well, it's not really a shock because they've been kind of slowly increasing their power and increasing, you know, their position at the top of the game. They tried to do it with Project Big Picture, those big teams trying to, you know, give themselves the golden votes, you know, the deciding votes and all that, in exchange for more money down the pyramid, which thankfully got rejected as well. But, you know, even in the Champions League reforms that have actually gone through now, and I hope they're reversed, but, you know, now in the Champions League, there's a coefficient. So basically, it's not only down to where you finish in your domestic league. It's also if you're a good historical team, i.e. one of the biggest teams in Europe, you know, like the biggest 12 that signed up for the Super League. If you're like historically a big team and you've got a good European coefficient, basically it gives you another way to get in. It's just it's a completely anti-competitive rule. And that going through has kind of gone under the radar a little bit. But these teams, they know no boundaries in trying to increase their, you know, stability at the top table and cutting everyone off. And even, yeah, as I say, the Champions League reforms have gone through now, which protect them even more. The Champions League rule now where there are going to be 6 teams in a group and therefore 10 games playing the other 5 home and away. So there are more matches now, despite massive justifiable concerns over player welfare, because obviously it brings in more money. So it's been happening for quite a long time now that these teams who sit at the top table are trying to cut off the ladders to everyone else below. And it's just that they just kind of view sport in a fundamentally different way. It's just like a cash cow for them, really. Whereas a lot of, you know, anyone who's a fan of football at any level knows that what is behind the what makes the sport great is competition. You know, it's the fact that you don't know who's going to win, and that anyone can do anything. You know, a team from the lower divisions like Bournemouth can go from League Two to the Premier League. Leicester can win the league in the era of all these massive clubs around them. And, you know, that's why the Premier League is the greatest league in the world. And that is also why a lot of people prefer watching the Premier League to the Champions League, you know, because you have got the whole like spectrum of teams in there and different levels and, you know, different revenue streams. And we've seen actually, ironically, since those big six teams were in English football had signed up and then kind of pulled out of that Super League, a lot of them were really struggling in their Premier League games. You know, Arsenal scraped a draw against Fulham, I think, with like a 97th minute goal. Sorry to remind you about that, Matthew. And I just think it shows the kind of absolute contempt that they hold fans and the sport in. It's just about lining their own pockets. And I think it is also as disheartening and cynical as all of that stuff is, I think it's also very heartening that football has shown that we can come together and unite over an issue, whereas, you know, general Premier League consensus or supporter consensus is very difficult to get. But everyone was so united against it. You know, managers were speaking out, players were speaking out, fans were demonstrating, protesting outside stadiums. It shows that we have got the power to stop these kind of changes happening in future, because this thing is going to happen again and we're going to need to mobilise so that we're ready to give the same kind of opposition to it when it does almost inevitably arise.
Well, let's bring in Matthew then, because Max has just said about the unity of fans and their mobilisation to try and put a stop to this. Off the back of that, once the Super League concept collapsed for now, there's then been protests against the boards of the dirty half dozen, as we can now label them. What do you think the ultimate fallout of that will be? Can you see any of those six, if at all, their ownership being sold to another entity? Is it just going to be noise? Is this something that's then forgotten by the start of next season? What do you think, Matthew?
I don't think many of them are going to sell, because when you look at the positions that they're in, you know, the owners of Manchester City are not in any way going to give up Manchester City. Man United are not going to give up, you know, the Glazers are not going to give up Man United. John W. Henry, I think they've accepted and moved on. I haven't heard much in the way of anything out of Liverpool since, you know, since his apology video. It might still be there, but it's not on a mass thing. Enoch are not going to sell Spurs, given the way they are. Chelsea, Abramovich is not going to sell Chelsea. So really the only one that, again, we've actually heard anything semi-concrete from this has been the Cronkies with Arsenal. And even then, when you hear the reports about, someone Ek, I've Daniel Ek, is it?
That's right, yep.
The guy who owns Spotify. I'm not a Spotify person, so yeah. That's really been the only news, but again, you hear the news coming out of the Cronkies. They are not gonna be in a position to sell. They've weathered worse than this. They weathered the Wenger years, and they were absolutely fine. So I don't think any of them are really going to be in a position to sell. I think, and you know, keeping it on the Arsenal front, I think the AFTV guys sort of did it incredibly well. Robbie, who's a fantastic host, sort of made the point: is will they offer something to make you, you know, as a bargaining chip? So they said, oh, if they bought Haaland or Mbappe as a theoretical, you know, would you forgive the Cronkies for all the stuff because it showed that you've got something? I think there is some element to that. I think so long as the boards do appease them in some way, whether it be something like, you know, freezing season ticket prices for next season because we haven't had a year in the ground, or if it's, you know, they, or if, you know, X club buys, you know, X big player. Just say, oh no, these owners are okay. I think for the most part, this is all going to go away. The only one, sort of, as I said, is the Arsenal one, but that's been a long-standing thing. So it was sort of flared up with the European Super League talk, but it's been an ongoing thing, so nothing has really changed on that front. So I don't think much is going to happen in the way of, you know, consequences for this.
Yeah, I'd have to agree. Even from a Spurs point of view, Enoch would have to get an offer that even they would struggle to refuse. When you look at their, well, what should we call it, property portfolio and all the development around the local area, it's all for them, not really for the fans or the locals in the North London postcode. It's kind of just all about making their own money. So it's great there's protest happening and it's good to see, but I do fear that it's kind of just going to get lost in the shuffle. You know, even if clubs win silverware, does that then dissipate any protest? It's going to be an issue that will run and run for as long as this Super League threat will run and run. And I think the Super League threat only really goes away if it ever materialises. So hopefully that's not the case. And as Max also said about Champions League and that wildcard entry, as we said, Matthew, that's very much least worst or the lesser of two evils. And that's been sort of slipped under in all the furore, hasn't it? So we're kind of hoping that that is reversed or tweaked. But if it isn't, then it's just that first small step into protectionism entering football as we know it. Right, that's enough Super League chat for now, because we can actually talk some football. We haven't really done so in a week or so. So let's go to Wembley and the Carabao Cup final. Max, I'll start with you. It may be 1-0 in the history books, but if you watch the game, that told nowhere near the full story now, did it?
Yeah, it didn't. It didn't. Because City were, I'm sure you won't mind me saying, City were pretty dominant. Yeah. but on the other side of the coin, I think Spurs will have done exactly what Mason wanted them to do, which is kind of generally contain City. You know, it wasn't a complete, they weren't completely steamrolling you, and you were still in the game at about 70, 80 minutes, you know. And I think his plan, probably because he's obviously had such a short amount of time with them, he won't have been able to you know, create some grand master plan of how he's going to pass Guardiola City off the pitch. I think his hope, and I'm probably massively oversimplifying here, his hope would probably be to stay in the game, keep it tight, and then hopefully nick one on the break via Son and Kane, like you did in the league earlier this season when you won 2-0. Because even that game, City had a lot of the possession, they had a lot of chances, but Spurs were just, you know, quite solid and were just ultra clinical with the couple of chances that they had. And in with about 10 minutes left, you were in a great position because it was 0-0. City were frustrated, you know, they'd been missing a lot of chances. And you know, you brought Bale on, you had Bale, Son and Kane, and I thought this is all set up for Spurs to maybe get a winner. But then obviously just a set piece, it was pretty poor marking from Moussa Sissoko. I'm not sure who Laporte's man was supposed to be, but Sissoko was kind of in the vicinity and not really paying attention. It will be frustrating to lose from a set piece, especially to someone, and I'm sure we'll get onto this, especially to someone who was maybe lucky to be on the pitch. Given his two challenges, which were definitely worthy of a yellow card. But I thought, I guess Spurs never looked really on top or anything. City were always the better team. But I think given that they got to 80 minutes and were still in the game at 0-0, and then had their, you know, their big front three, I think Spurs will maybe be disappointed, especially with the manner of the goal they conceded.
Yeah, I think we summed up, it's a lack of football intelligence from players like Aurier and Sissoko, and just the fact that, you know, you can defend gallantly for 80 minutes, but it's that last 10 minutes that matters the most. It's not rugby, it's football, isn't it? And that extra allocation of time, you still need to see that job out at the same time. So Matthew, in terms of Ryan Mason's Wembley fairy tale, shall I say, I wouldn't go as far as it turned into a nightmare, because it could have been like a bloodbath like the 2019 FA Cup final where Watford were decimated by Manchester City. It wasn't that, but he was outwitted by Pep Guardiola. There's no shame in that, because many better and senior managers have also been in the past. So it really did just show the considerable gulf in managerial nous between Guardiola and Mason.
Yeah, it did. And you know, as you said, Ryan Mason, it was going to have to take some miracle for Ryan Mason to pull anything off. But you know, the comments that have been coming out of it, you know, it's been, you know, would Jose Mourinho's side have put up a bare fight? And I think they would. You know, I don't think, you know, under Jose Mourinho, I don't think Man City would have got as many chances as they would have done under Ryan Mason. And, you know, I don't want to say this was like an audition for him, because I'm 99% certain that Ryan Mason is not going to be the manager of Spurs next season. Even if he does go on this, you know, like Ole Gunnar Solskjaer did when he took over, and, you know, Ollie's at the wheel that period in time, that strange period in time. I don't think that's going to be the case for Ryan Mason now. You know, even if he wins 5 games, I want to say, you've got left of the season, 5 games on the bounce.
Yeah.
I don't think there's really going to be any chance for him. So it's a good fairy tale, as you say. You know, he had his career cut short. He was a Spurs, you know, fan, born and bred, came through the academy. Yeah. It's a good fairy tale, but, you know, in the cold light of day, it just goes to show that, you know, there's a lot more to come from him when it comes to being a manager, because he can't even sort of use the Southampton game as anything, because Southampton are in, not free fall, but aren't exactly the greatest of teams at the moment. So maybe it's something to address in later years. Maybe he needs to go out and, you know, like Lampard did, go to the Championship or something for a year. But yeah, he didn't exactly do himself any favours when it came to saying, right, which manager's going to, you know, what club should take him on as a manager going forward.
Yeah, I mean, if we're honest, he hasn't made a difficult decision for Daniel Levy, has he? I mean, there's a manager out there somewhere, which we'll get to in a moment, and I don't think it's Ryan Mason. You'd have to go quite substantially down the list or fail at negotiating with maybe even half a dozen names. So as you say, Matthew, I don't think Ryan Mason's going to be the man in charge come August. But Max, you alluded to the biggest talking point of the game. Let's open that up a bit more. Aymeric Laporte, his presence on the field. Now, you're right, there was 2 tackles worthy of a yellow card. One was shown, and he gets the winner. So, should he have been on the pitch, or, playing devil's advocate, if he makes the first one and gets a yellow card, does he then have enough defensive nous to not make the second one? Or are we sort of then going into a rather moot direction? What do you think?
Yeah, it is difficult, right? Because City would say, and I think justifiably, because Laporte is a clever enough defender to know that he whether he's booked or not. And so I think if he gets booked for the first one, he just lets Lucas go by him and he doesn't make that tackle. You know, he only makes that second one because he knows he wasn't booked for the first one. He knows he can pick up a booking. And then from that point onwards, he can then kind of ease off a little bit. It's difficult to say because, you know, like when the ref doesn't show him a yellow card, my mate always says it kind of splits off into a parallel universe now, because in one parallel universe, sure, like maybe Laporte gets given a yellow card for that first one. And then, you know, maybe he gets a yellow for the second one and gets a red. But you can't say that with any certainty. It's just obviously frustrating for fans who will say, well, his second challenge, you know, is on the same player. It was also worthy of a yellow card. And that one got given. Why did the first one not get given? Especially when he showed, you know, yellow cards to other players early on in the game. And, you know, I can understand you don't want to make the game all about you, because, you know, there are some refs, for example, Mike Dean or Mark Clattenburg, who are kind of widely seen as a little bit individualistic when they're refereeing. They're a little bit, you know, kind of making it about themselves and, you know, playing up to the drama of everything. And so I kind of understand, you know, not wanting to go around showing cards like confetti in the first 2 minutes of the game. But at the same point, a yellow is a yellow is a yellow. Whatever minute of the game, whatever the opponents are, whatever level you're playing at, it's a yellow, and it should have been a yellow. And, you know, Spurs fans will justifiably say, well, he should have been off. But then, you know, as you say, on the other side of the coin, I think Laporte probably wouldn't have made the second one if he'd made the first.
This is it, Matthew. If you go by what you see, those two events do equal a red card. But as you say, Max, that if one event happens sooner than it should, then obviously the narrative of the game and how it's going to then play out changes. So does the responsibility really lie with Paul Tierney here, Matthew? Because they say that you shouldn't referee a final different to a Premier League game. It should just be a game. But it's kind of the occasion got the better of the referee. What do you think?
I think there is some argument to that. But I also think, you know, as part of this discussion, you know, should he have been booked for the yellow card? I think we are also sort of dangerously teetering on and you know, it's been the topic all season, you know, VAR, and, you know, how much do you allow VAR to control in that sense? Because, you know, in this situation, whilst Paul Ten didn't give the yellow card for the first one, that could be a thing, you know, do you want VAR to intervene on that sort of tackle? You know, should there be a yellow card on this sort of thing? So I think when we're talking about these sort of things, we are dangerously teetering on, right, we need to look at this for the future to make sure that it doesn't happen again. But on Pulteney, yeah, I think there is some element of that. I think the occasion, as we did get to the better of him. The best example I can think of was it the 2009 League Cup final when Man United gave away, I think it was Nemanja Vidic, gave away a penalty inside the first minute on Agbon Lahore, and he should have got a red card, but the referee on the day didn't.
He just gave a penalty
rather than sending, I think it was Vidic off. So there has been some occasions on it in the past, and you know, it wouldn't surprise me if this was the same situation again for Tierney.
Yeah, I think the referee had a bad game, but that's not the reason for Tottenham's demise. I think there are far more pressing concerns than that. And Max, when we look at players not turning up, their ages, them being senior, you could look at Tottenham, I don't know, 8 out of 11 who had a bad day. But then you look at Phil Foden, he's junior. Really, he's the kind of player that, by his age and by the kind of circumstance of football, should be having a struggle at Wembley. Nothing of the sort. Absolutely delightful to watch, even as a Tottenham fan, I thought.
Yeah, he was just absolutely superb, wasn't he? Guardiola has just kind of shown that you don't need a striker when you play football, which goes against the kind of the principles of English football. It used to be you needed two strikers, and then you know it's kind of evolved to maybe like 4-2-3-1 and only playing with one up top. And now he's just playing six midfielders, and he's just doing great, isn't he? You know, Foden playing, or Sterling, or De Bruyne even playing false nine. But yeah, I thought Foden was the best player on the pitch, and he's what, 20, and he's got 7 major trophies. It also shows, I think, which is a point that has been debated by people before, but basically previously, people have said, oh, you know, why aren't you playing Foden? He's got the talent to play. Why aren't you playing him? You need to play him more. And I think Guardiola has shown that he is handling him perfectly, because it's easy when you have someone who is super talented and very young, it's easy to play them 50 games a season, which is what happened to Jack Wilshere, and look what's happened to him now. You know, his career has been beset by injuries. Whereas Foden, he's kind of introduced him very slowly, kind of gradually. He's very good with, you know, the resting and the rotation and kind of allowing him, because he's got a very slight frame, you know, he's got a very slender frame. He's got kind of very skinny legs. He obviously gets fouled a lot. He gets kicked a lot. So someone of that build is, and obviously so young, you know, he maybe hasn't fully matured in terms of his physiology. It would be very easy to overplay him, and then, you know, and then you kind of burn him out by the age of 22, 23 for England and for City. But Guardiola has managed him really fantastically well, and he's showing now that he can turn up in the big games. He played in both Champions League quarter-final legs, didn't he? He obviously scored in both, was instrumental in the League Cup final, and I really hope he starts for England. And I also hope that City continue to kind of use this rotation policy. But it's interesting because Sterling was the main man, you know, last season and the season before. I think he scored 25 goals in all competitions last season, Sterling. And now he's been usurped, really. And I wonder whether Gareth will also carry that into England.
Well, Matthew, I was going to ask you a question about Phil Foden and the England rattle, because I was going to first say, is this an outside shout or not? Is he going to be actually part of that 23? But a 23 is now a 26. So what do you make of that for the Euros?
I don't even think it's a question of if he's in the 23 or the 26. I think the question now is whether or not he starts.
Okay, should we have a rattle
and,
for
and
the start,
honestly,
then?
I would be in this. I don't think there's any reason or any justification for why he can't start for England, or why he shouldn't. Because if you're going on, you know, the form team, you know, the form players at the moment, which is how, you know, Jesse Lingard has managed to get himself into the equation. You know, Phil Foden is arguably, you know, one of the form players for England at this stage. Now, I don't know quite where you would put him. You know, if it's the fourth, we still don't know what formation Gareth Southgate is going to play. Not that I care. I'm more focusing on whether or not Gareth Bale's going to be healthy. But if it's like a 4-3-3, do you play him out on the left, or do you play him central? Or if it's a 3-4-3, do you play him as one of the middlemen or do you play him out on the left sort of thing? I think it is a case of whether or not he starts, because again, there are some other talented players. Like, again, if you're putting him in contention on the left, again, that's where, you know, does Jack Grealish fit in that place as well? Or does Jadon Sancho get that place back? Or does Sterling get that place back? So I think it is a question. He will go, he will be on the bus. I think that is pretty much confirmed. It is now just a case of whether or not he starts. And if he plays, keeps playing the way he does, I don't think there's really any excuse for Phil Foden not to be starting the games for England in the summer.
Okay, Matthew, I'll stay with you because I've got a genuine rattle question now. Now there's three more seats on the bus. Is Jude Bellingham on the bus? In a kind of Theo Walcott 2006 youngster kind of vein, is that going to be the role for him?
I think it is, yes. So we'll get the formalities out of the way. Yes, I say England rattle for Jude Bellingham. And I think it's not quite the Theo Walcott situation. Because the Theo Walcott situation was, you know, he hadn't played for Arsenal, I don't think, at that point. He'd signed, I can't remember what the deal was with his transfer, but he hadn't played a Premier League game up to that point. Whereas Jude Bellingham has been playing a regular in the Bundesliga. He's been playing in the Champions League. He's played for England before. So it won't be as much of a shock as it would. Whereas, you know, when Theo Walcott got announced, you know, it was this big, major, uncapped player, not played a Premier League appearance. You know, what is Sven Goran Eriksson doing? Because he left the likes of Jermaine Defoe, I think, didn't go.
That's right, yeah.
Darren Bent, I think, was the other one. Again, an informed name that didn't go to the World Cup. So I don't think it would be a shock if Jude Bellingham went. He is in the same sort of situation. Again, you could make the argument, based on how he played against Man City, you know, a couple of weeks ago in the Champions League, you can make the case for him starting in the England 11. But I think he probably would have been in the 23 anyway. But that making it 26 probably just, you know, confirms it at this stage, I would say.
I would have to agree there. Max, I'm going to stay in Germany very quickly because Julian Nagelsmann is going to be the next Bayern boss. Bad news for Spurs fans, me included. Bad news for the Bundesliga, really, because I think the domination will continue for the Allianz Arena outfit.
Yeah, pretty much. and not only that, but they've also signed a lot of... So, of course, Bayern are losing a lot of kind of big players on free transfers, particularly defenders. I think Alaba's going possibly to Real Madrid, Boateng's going. But then they've also signed some players on free transfers, which is their absolute speciality. So they got, what's his name? The Leipzig centre-back, Upamecano.
Yeah.
So not only have they kind of taken the manager off their biggest rivals in the Bundesliga, they've also taken one of their best players as well. I just think the kind of European dominance, not only German dominance, is only set to continue for Bayern because they're just an absolute powerhouse. And Nagelsmann is one of the best young coaches around. You know, Flick has done a good job there. I can see him maybe going to Germany when Löw leaves after the summer. But yeah, I can really see a long spell of dominance for Bayern going forward.
Well, it's just Bayern's MO, isn't it? And I think it's more telling for Borussia Dortmund that they used to be the club that everyone used to... Well, not everyone. Bayern used to pluck from. And now it's Leipzig, isn't it? That's more of a testament to Dortmund's relative decline in the last few years. I guess Dortmund would be happy they haven't lost Haaland. But, you know, never say never with that either. From a Spurs point of view, not getting Nagelsmann, I think the crucial element in all of this is Hansi Flick leaving Bayern. Because without that departure, I think Nagelsmann is not a shoe-in for Spurs. But I think that's more viable. But I think the Bayern connection has obviously accelerated such progress in that direction, and Spurs are now going to be scratching around. Well, scratching around is unfair, but you're looking at names like Ten Hag, Eddie Howe, Graham Potter. It's not an amazingly illustrious list, but we are where we are. Right, let's actually chat about the Premier League now, because we need to go to Monday night, and Max, usually Palace are towards the bottom of the show. I don't know if it's not on purpose, but they seem to always just kind of be there. So I do apologise for their placing this season, but they're a bit more higher up the show this week, so I want to chat about their efforts at the King Power last night. And based on the performance, I thought it was a bit harsh on Palace not to get a point. I thought with the chance they created, they were certainly good value for something.
I think unfair is maybe a bit strong. It wasn't like a smash and grab or anything, but definitely Leicester could not have had any arguments if we'd got a point. We definitely had the chances. They were just a little bit more clinical. They kind of showed their class at the end in coming through. Palace have conceded a lot of late goals. Sky Sports stat came up towards the end of the game, showing that we've conceded the most goals in the division in the last 15 minutes, which is a problem because it happened against Leicester in the reverse fixture. We were at Selhurst Park earlier this season. We were 1-0 up, and then Barnes scored with about 5 minutes left. And then, you know, and then we go 1-0 up, and they peg us back late on as well. In terms of chances, I thought we did pretty well considering we'd had a more than 2 week gap since our last game, whereas Leicester have been kind of ticking over with fixtures. And you can say in this kind of overcrowded era of Premier League fixtures, it's nice to have a bit of a rest. But I mean, we had about 2 weeks before the previous game as well. So I just feel like the players, they may be a little bit out of match practice due to kind of being moved around by the Premier League for cup fixtures and all of that. So that probably didn't help. But I thought we showed up pretty well. I think a draw would have been a fair result. It was a good goal we scored. Obviously, they come back into it. The equaliser, it was a little bit unlucky, maybe from our perspective, because Kouyaté kind of challenged Iheanacho and then just slipped in the box. And then they had a man extra. Really good finish from Castagna. And then the goal at the end, I don't even think it was particularly bad defending. I mean, ideally, you wouldn't have wanted to let Iheanacho get back on his left foot, but it was just a quality, quality goal. He's in fantastic form right now. And then the game just kind of petered out a bit. And yeah, I thought we did pretty well. I'm not too disheartened by the result. It's just a bit of a shame that they kind of took their chances. And then we had the Riedewald one-on-one and then the Benteke free header in the 6-yard box, and we didn't make the most of it.
I think on the evidence of that performance, it suggests that Palace aren't just thinking, okay, season's done. There is a bit of fight there, which you want to see. And Matthew, if you ended the season today, Palace would be 13th. And I think that's about par. I think, you know, if you were to say to Max at the start of the season, where do you realistically think you finish? I think 13th wouldn't be an outrageous suggestion. However, they can't afford to really take the foot off the gas because they could get swallowed up by three, maybe four teams if results go against them. So we've spoken before about a strong finish needed for Hodgson and all of that. So now it's about actually making sure that happens to secure a new contract for the elder statesman.
Yeah, you could say that. Although I think, you know, as we said, we are a pretty pro Roy Hodgson show on this thing. But I just think the way things are, it's coming to an end for Roy Hodgson. And again, you hear all the reports again with stuff that I do at work. It seems likely at this stage. Again, from what I've been hearing, from what other people have been hearing, it seems like Sean Dyche is going to be sliding into the dugout at Selhurst Park at the end of the season. So I think if there's going to be any performances, it's really going to be for the players themselves rather than, you know, trying to prove something for Royton. You can, again, there's the money side of it as well, because if they slide three or four places down, then that's about £10 million worth of league placing money. But for the most part, I think the players are going to want to put in a good performance just to show that, you know, to at least try and secure a contract for next season, whether that be Sean Dyche, you know, who I do think is going to be the man they're going to take, or whoever the new manager is going to be, just to at least say, right, at least if I can prove myself here, then I have a contract lined up for next season, whether or not the new manager and whether or not the new manager is going to want me. So I think that's what the performances are going to be for, rather than trying to keep Roy Hodgson in a job, as it were.
Let's bring in Max. Max, your take on all things Roy. Do you think these are the final days of his tenure at Selhurst?
I think so. In his last press conference, now he's actually been quite reserved in kind of revealing information about whether he's going to be there next year and kind of his future and the player's future and all of that. And he's always batted it away and said, oh, you know, I don't know, you'll have to ask the club and whatever. But he made some kind of comments in his last press conference before the Leicester game, where he seemed to me to be indicating that he was going to leave. Basically, he was asked, you know, about his future at the club. And he said, well, you know, I've got thoughts on what's happening, but I'm not going to share them with you yet. You know, I'll tell you about it at a later point. And to me, that seems like he's been told or he's been informed that they're going to let him go, and he maybe doesn't agree with the decision. But, you know, he doesn't want to start mouthing off about it because he's too much of a professional. And, you know, maybe when Palace have installed a new manager and things have died down a bit, he might have his say on whether he thinks it was a bit unfair. because, you know, he's not showing any indications of wanting to stop. I think if Palace offered him a deal, he'd obviously love to carry on. But now I'm completely speculating based on his comments. You know, other people might interpret that a different way. But to me, that seems a little bit like he is maybe expecting or knowing that he's going to leave at the end of the season.
As for Leicester, though, Matthew, they're 7 points clear of fifth place. And with their running, which includes Man United, Chelsea and Tottenham, they may need all of those 7 points just to make sure they get over the line. Is there going to be Champions League football at the King Power next season?
I think there will be. And, you know, all credit to Rodgers for doing so. You know, we talked about it last season, whether or not, you know, this would give them the boost to, you know, the fact that they fell short last season, whether or not it would give them the impetus to try and get over the hump this season. And I think it probably has played its part because they haven't exactly been on the greatest form recently. And this did seem like a potential, you know, quote-unquote banana skin for Leicester City. So this was probably one of those games where you think, if they are going to do it, these are the games that you really, you know, as much as there are six-pointers coming up against Man United and Chelsea, this is the sort of game where if you can't win these games, then you are pretty much, you know, surrendering your place. You're not going down without much of a fight, as it were. So I think it was, you know, pretty good for them to pick up the win against Crystal. It just gave them 7 points, because in effect that's really three wins that the other team needs to pick up. So that's a pretty big statement, and yeah, it's probably done just enough to get them over the line.
Well, their last five fixtures are Southampton, Newcastle, Man United, Chelsea, Tottenham. Now, the last three, on paper, do sound difficult, but there's also some mitigating circumstance in that. Man United, the title race should be done and dusted by then, and they'll probably be all eyes on Europa League, so rest and recuperate, all of that. Chelsea is Chelsea. It could just be a mutual celebration by that point, and Tottenham aren't the Tottenham that should be or were at the start of the season under Jose Mourinho. You know, they're not really a force, so that could be a dead rubber. So I think that win against Crystal Palace on Monday might be the crucial one that, although it's not mathematically set just yet, is probably the one that just gives them enough of a buffer, and even if they finish fourth, they'll be in the Champions League next season. Now, of course, they took full advantage of drop points on Saturday, because drop points were always going to come from somewhere, especially in the West Ham versus Chelsea game. A game match that Chelsea won, and now top four qualification is back in their hands also.
Yeah, very much, very much. It was a good performance from Chelsea, because we've seen that that front two of kind of Bowen and Lingard really, really trouble teams, and they've actually adapted pretty well to being without Declan Rice, and, you know, and being without Ogbonna as well, I think, who's one of their key players. And so, yeah, they've adapted pretty well to their injuries, you know, obviously Antonio being out as well, West Ham. So they've been scoring two, three goals a game for the last month or so. So for Chelsea to kind of neutralise that threat, I think shows that they're a really, really strong team defensively. And, you know, they also kind of shut Man City down in the FA Cup semi, which is also a marker of how good they are. And yeah, they've really impressed me under Tuchel. I'm sure we'll talk about the Balbuena red card.
Yep.
And obviously that didn't help West Ham's cause, but I think Chelsea probably deserved it. And based on this kind of performance, if they keep that up, they'll probably deserve to finish in the Champions League spots as well.
Well, when you look at their results, if you looked on just results themselves, you think, oh, Chelsea aren't a particularly entertaining team, but they're winning by small margins and not necessarily parking the bus either. They seem to have the balance between attack and defence spot on. And if Timo Werner really had his shooting boots on, that could have been a much more comprehensive victory in East London. But Matthew, by the same token, West Ham just starting to run out of steam now. Back-to-back defeats. Is the Champions League dream just slipping away ever so slightly?
I think it is. I think when you looked at the teams that are, you know, competing for the top four, West Ham were always probably going to be the team that you felt, if there's anyone that's going to fall away, it probably would be them. You know, similar to Leicester last season, you know, the expectations and is the squad quality really there? You were probably always going to expect West Ham to be the ones that fell away. And when you're coming up against a team like Chelsea, you know, they've had a fantastic defensive record under Tuchel and all this sort of thing. It was always going to come down to that. So I think that they are still in the driving seat because they are still fourth, aren't they?
No, not anymore. Oh, they're fifth. They're 7 points from Leicester.
I haven't checked that part of the table for a while yet. But yeah, so they probably have, you know, I don't want to say thrown it away because it's still a fantastic season for them. If they get into the Europa League, yeah, it's not quite the Champions League, but again, European football at the London Stadium, which is what, you know, the owners have been promising for them for, you know, years now. It's just rewards for, you know, what has been a good season for them, even if, and I quantify this with what I have said previously, even if they have taken advantage of the other teams just being absolutely terrible. I mean, they've deserved it, but let's quantify with the fact that Spurs and Liverpool and Arsenal have all had their respective meltdowns.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at West Ham at the start of the season, if someone said European football, you'd be absolutely mad to suggest it. But, of course, expectations change as performances improve. And I think the fact that West Ham have had a taste of the top four, to not be in the top four will be disappointment, and rightly so. Now, really, it's a case of it's probably edged away. Can they then solidify a top six? I think even a top seven finish now, thanks to Man City winning the Carabao Cup. So it would have to take an element of freefall between now and these last five matches for them not to finish in a European place. And arguably, they kind of deserve it. It's nice to see someone else, not a plucky underdog, but another team just mix it up and have a crack at playing in Europe and mixing it with the big six. I think the Premier League needs that also. So as much as it pains me to say as a Spurs fan, credit must go to West Ham. But as Max said, the real talking point is not a Timo Werner goal. It's the fact that West Ham had 10 men for a large portion of the game. And Max, when you look at it, what else can Valbuena do in that instance? What was your take on the red card offence at the London Stadium?
Yeah, well, I think you're right to ask the question, what else can Valbuena do? Because he's cleared the ball and then the Chilwell has kind of subsequently come into view and into, you know, within range of his boot. But I'm just baffled, really. It's just one of those where the ref looks at about 15 slow motion replays. He sees the boot hit Chilwell on his leg and he thinks, oh, therefore it must be a red card. And I'm just baffled and bemused at the lack of game understanding that referees have. I don't know if any of them have ever played football at any level, but I think anyone who has, and even if you haven't, even if you're just a regular long-standing fan of football, of the sport, I think you would say Balbuena was just clearing it. And the contact after was just kind of incidental and obviously accidental and he couldn't do anything about it. And it's just one of those things, you know, football's a contact sport. And so, yeah, for it not to get given and then to be overturned as a clear and obvious error as well, I despair, really, because it really shouldn't have been a red card. And I suppose Dale Johnson suggested in his excellent VAR thread on Twitter, give him a follow if you don't already, he suggested that the referee, the VAR, I should say, was maybe influenced by previous kind of similar-ish challenges, which have happened like Liam Cooper on Jesus and I think like John Stones, maybe challenging someone else. There are other Palace examples. I think Mamadou Sakho got sent off last season against Bournemouth. I don't know if you remember that. Maybe it's a bit of an obscure game. But basically, he cleared the ball and then got the Bournemouth right-back, Adam Smith, was kind of closing him down as he was clearing the ball. And Sakho kicked the ball, you know, smashed the ball 70 yards away, very clean contact with the ball. And as Smith was kind of sprinting towards him to close him down, Sacco's studs just kind of clipped the edge of Smith's knee. And it was a straight red and a 3-game ban. And yeah, I mean, maybe the ref was kind of pressured into wanting to be consistent given the Liam Cooper tackle on Jesus. And I do understand, you know, you want to be consistent. Of course, fans want consistency. But, you know, the Cooper challenge was completely different because he was kind of sliding and a little bit out of control. And I've said that I don't think a red card for Cooper was unfair. I think, you know, you could have easily given that Cooper challenge as a red card. And that was a fair result. But Balbuena was not out of control. He was just standing up, clearing the ball. You know, he wasn't sliding in or anything. And it's just that kind of Chilwell arrived a bit later and obviously copped a bit of a knock and thought, right, well, this is an opportunity for me to get someone sent off here. And I obviously don't think it helps that Chilwell was rolling around pretending he was injured. when obviously as soon as Balbuena was sent off, he just jumped back to his feet and got on with the game like he was completely fine. And that's an aspect of it that annoys me as well. But I mean, obviously his decision to do that has been vindicated because Balbuena did get a red card. And probably the Chilwell reaction maybe pushed the ref into making that decision as well. But I'm really disappointed by it.
As always, Matthew, it's about consistency or a lack thereof. And if Balbuena was given his marching orders, why was Coufal not at least handed a booking for something similar? In the second instance, there wasn't even any VAR. So how on earth can you have one approach and not the other? Surely there has to be a form of uniformity during that game.
Yeah, absolutely. And this does come down to, you know, this is where, you know, VAR comes into this. Do you want to have VAR for subjective things? You know, is this a foul? Is this not a foul? Is this a penalty? That's, again, we're sort of getting into dangerous territory of, you know, rewriting the rule books, as it were. And, you know, yeah, consistency has arguably been the biggest problem this season. You could say VAR has been effective in, you know, it's been there to make the decisions, but it's always been the humans that are in charge of it that have been the biggest problems. And one referee may see it differently to a different referee, and so on and so forth. You can have 10 different opinions on the same incident if you ask 10 different people. So it is probably something that they need to look at over the summer, whether or not they need to, you know, make the rules more clear, or if they need to give instructions to the referees themselves. But yeah, consistency has been a huge problem over the season, and has, you know, diminished what has, you know, arguably been, I would still say, has been the great work the VAR has done, but it has diminished its effectiveness somewhat this year.
Yeah, I mean, you've got people like Gary Lineker and Rio Ferdinand demanding a great switch off, which I don't think will happen because I think we've come too far. But as you say, Matthew, when you see what happens on Saturday at London Stadium, you think we're a long way away from it being seamless compared to sports like cricket and rugby. It's nowhere near that. So I think we're going to be due for a bit more pain over the next couple of years. And then hopefully it's just an integral part of any 90 minutes, but we're not there yet. Of course, Chelsea certainly made good on Liverpool dropping points earlier in the day. And Max, if we're talking about lone captures of the season, obviously Jesse Lingard wins that crown along with the Ballon d'Or. But Joe Willock must be the runner-up because his contribution for Newcastle has been absolutely crucial as of late, hasn't it?
Yeah, and also Young Player of the Year for Lingard as well, you forgot.
Yeah, absolutely.
just a very, very, very quick point on VAR before I talk about Willock. Yeah, yeah. It's kind of messed with the mechanics of the game a little bit, which is because yesterday Palace scored against Leicester, right? And it looked like it was offside, and I was just completely stony-faced and expressionless and didn't allow myself the happiness that we'd scored. Because I was like, oh, they're going to check it. It'll be offside. And then they even looked at the challenge where I think Benteke won the ball back from Tielemans, and it wasn't a foul at all. But I was just thinking, oh, shit, what if they're going to give that as a foul? And then finally the goal got confirmed. And at that point, you don't really feel like going crazy because the time where you want to have that kind of emotional reaction to it is instantly, you know, as soon as the goal goes in. And I just thought it was really sad that I didn't even get that chance, you know, that 10 seconds, which is your happiest time as a football fan. And, you know, the reason that you watch. And even that was kind of taken away because I was just defecating bricks that it was going to be taken away for some stupid reason, which is really sad. But moving on to Willock, he's been really good. And what surprises me is that Newcastle fans, or maybe I should say what surprises me is that Newcastle are playing people like Shelvey and Hendrick regularly, and Joe Willock is showing that he has the quality to play more regularly. And still, Bruce is maybe only trusting him with the last 20 minutes. And then, you know, so Maximan was saying, I know he was kind of coming back from an injury, and Bruce obviously wants to manage that a little bit. But so Maximan was saying, look, I'm fully fit, I'm ready. And then Bruce was waiting 70 minutes before bringing him on and kind of hoping that it was 0-0 at that point. And then, you know, bring Willock and so Maximan on, and then they're good enough that they can maybe change the game and get a goal. Why not start Willock? He's shown he's got the quality. I think it's just a shame he's not getting more of a run out, really, because he's only getting 15, 20 minutes at the end of matches, and he's doing really well in those end of matches, and he's shown he's got a goal scoring touch. And, you know, Arsenal have a real question now about whether they want to keep him, because he's arguably good enough to be in that squad. Obviously, Newcastle are going to want him as well, but I'm just surprised they're not playing him more.
Well, exactly. He's the super sub, but he's been worth 5 points to Newcastle. And Matthew, those 5 points really have killed off any hope of the playoff that you were banking on the final day. So I know you've always kind of consigned your own fate throughout the season, but with Newcastle's emergence or resurgence, is there now an overwhelming acceptance that Fulham are done?
Yeah, because it's been how the results have sort of progressed over the weekend. Because when Newcastle get their point, you think, oh, that's them probably, you know, too far out of reach. Because I always say, you know, as long as we're within 3 points of them in the going into the last game, because of how goal difference would have worked and everything, as long as we're within 3 points, then I'm happy. But then they start to pull away. So you're thinking, right, who's next? Oh, I can't remember who was next. I think it may have been Brighton were coming up next. Thing. All right, it was Burnley, that was it. As long as we can keep Burnley within 3 points, because we've got them coming up soon. In a couple of weeks. So you think, oh, if we can, you know, get 3 points out of that, it's a six-pointer. Oh, we can maybe claw them back, depending on how good. And then they go and win at Wolves, so that gets rid of that. And then, again, now you're just looking at who's the next team around you, and it's Brighton. And I think they're seven points away from us at this point and have a vastly superior goal difference. And we don't have the benefit of playing them. So, again, six-pointer in that situation. So, yeah, it is starting to... Like, again, I can sign the fate more or less the day after we won the playoff final. So I'm you know, content, not content, but...
You've made peace with yourself, haven't you?
Yeah, made peace with it. Yeah, I made peace with this long time ago. It's just a case of, oh, you've given us that brief glimmer of hope, but now it's slowly ebbing away.
Of course, Matthew, sorry, yes, I'll stay with you, because Willock scored in injury time and Callum Wilson had an effort scrubbed out seconds before. So what did you make of that decision not to give Newcastle a goal through the ex-Bournemouth striker?
I'm afraid that this is another game. I'm going to have to plead the fifth. I've missed that one, I'm afraid. I was busy working on the weekend. I haven't managed to have a chance to catch it up.
Right then,
I'll plead the fifth on that.
I'll swing over to Max. Max, what did you make of the decision not to give Callum Wilson a goal?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it's consistent with the rest of the rulings that have been this season. So, you know, we can't say, oh, it's a decision that's come completely out of the blue. I think what a lot of fans will say is he obviously hasn't meant that. And if anything, he's actually got a bit of a push from Alexander-Arnold in the back before that, which kind of makes him trip forward and maybe contributes to his arm hitting the ball. Now, don't get me wrong, I don't think the Alexander-Arnold nudge was enough to give a penalty, but I think possibly the officials could look at that and say, well, that's a mitigating factor in the ball hitting Wilson's arm, because he obviously hasn't meant it and he's probably a bit off balance from that nudge that Alexander-Arnold has given him. I think, you know, 99% of football fans would say that's not handball, he hasn't meant it. I think what's also frustrating is the difference between the defensive and the attacking rules for handball. So, for example, we saw something very similar in the Man United game when the ball hit Shaw's arm. Now, that was a defensive situation, right? It was in United's own area. Shaw's the United defender. The ball kind of hit his arm by his side. And basically, the rule in defensive situations is that if it hits your arm by accident, whatever, play on. In attacking situations, it's different because obviously the ball hit Wilson's arm and that was accidental. But if it kind of leads to a goal, you know, in an attacking situation, the rules are different. And that itself is an inconsistency. And I think probably Newcastle are hard done by. The officials were abiding by what the rules are, but I think maybe a lot of people will look at the rule and say, well, I don't think that's handball. Maybe we should tweak the rule slightly.
Now, Matthew, during that game, Liverpool wasted so many chances, and it's getting to the point where it's lazy just to say Liverpool's issues are because of the defence. I think the attack need to take some of the blame for themselves. They certainly can't be absolved. Now, of those attackers, will Liverpool need to sell one of them to start a regeneration project during the summer? I don't think Mo Salah goes. I don't think you get maximum value for Roberto Firmino. So, could you see Sadio Mane being the sacrificial lamb at Anfield over the summer?
Yeah, if it is going to be one of the three, I think it is probably going to be Sadio Mane, because you have to sell one of them, because I don't think Diogo Jota is going to be willing to have another season as their backup, in effect. So he's probably going to want to start. And you do think they do need to freshen things up a little bit. And again, it seems harsh because of, you know, it's been three, maybe even longer, I forget when they all sort of came together. Three fantastic seasons of Salah, Firmino and Mane just ripping everyone apart. But whether or not it is fatigue because of, as you know, as a point we've talked about all season long on this, Jurgen Klopp's style of play combined with a congested fixture schedule, and whether or not they've got tired and can't keep up, and whether or not they will just need a long summer's rest to recuperate, or if it is, you know, mental fatigue and again things just need to be refreshed. Something does need to be done, and if you were going to sell one of them, you probably could still get a decent chunk for Sadio Mane. Slot Diogo Jota in his place. And you've even got the likes of Minamino coming back as well to consider. So yeah, he probably will be the one to go. But I can't see how you wouldn't get anything in 50 million minimum for Mane. Seems about right for if you can find the right buyer. So with that money, they can go and buy, you know, the next James Milner, for instance, or. Trying to think where else they need to improve on. Or, you know, another central midfielder, because I think that's another sort of weak-ish position for them. So, yeah, there is money to be got, and there are positions that need to be spent on.
Right, this is going to be the quickest of quickfire rounds, because we've got five games still to cover in about 2 minutes. So, basically, one-word answers will be sufficient. Max, Wolves versus Burnley. An emphatic win for Burnley. Are Wolves on the beach?
Possibly, yeah.
Okay, Leeds versus Manchester United. Matthew, 5 points for three matches for Leeds. Doesn't sound a lot, but when you consider their opposition during those three, I think Bielsa has to be credited for a job very well done.
Very much so. I would make the argument in contention for manager of the season.
I like it. Max, Arsenal versus Everton. Are Arsenal fully on that Europa League or bust mode now?
Yeah.
Lovely stuff. And Matthew, Villa versus West Brom. Is it fair to say that Sam Allardyce is staring down the barrel of a first ever Premier League relegation?
He is, but as I've said before, it probably goes with a bit of an asterisk because he took them over when they were already in the relegation zone.
I'll allow it. And Sheffield United versus Brighton, I'll take a good win for the Blades, but one that's come far too late. Right, that neatly brings us to full time. We've just got all those results in, so well done to us. I just need to do the admin, which is as simple as thanking my two Pod Squad members for their fantastic efforts this afternoon. Max, thanks for your time this afternoon. I hope you enjoyed that one.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Good to be back.
Lovely stuff. And Matthew, thank you for wearing the captain's armband this week. A pleasure to chat to you, as always.
Yep, same right back at you.
Lovely stuff. Cheers, guys, and also to the listeners out there. And with that said, it just leaves me to say that my name's Dan Tracy. This is The Real Football Cast. And until next time, goodbye.
This podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.